Mr. Levenger, we'll call first case. That's Hale versus Ron King. And Mr. Levenger, we'll hear from you first, representing Mr. Hale.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The issue here, as framed by this court, is whether Title II of the ADA validly abrogates 11th Amendment sovereign immunity for the conduct of a state that violates Title II but does not rise to the level of a 14th Amendment violation. That issue, in turn, depends on whether Title II is a congruent and proportional response to a history of unconstitutional treatment for disabled state prisoners. The answer to that question, I submit, is yes. And it's driven by the Supreme Court's recent opinions in Hibbs, 2003 opinion, Lane, 2004, and U.S. v. Georgia, 2006. Now, I think it's notable that the United States has agreed with our position as to the abrogation of immunity. And the state of Mississippi, while not expressly agreeing with our position, has also not expressly disagreed. And I think the state's lack of a substantive response would seem to confirm the congruence and proportionality of Title II in the context of the state prison systems. I think it's useful to begin with three propositions that can't be seriously disputed. First, in Title II, Congress expressly made clear its intent to abrogate.
Before you get to that, should we get to that issue, it seems like a threshold issue perhaps is whether a violation of Title II has been stated. And one thing in your brief I have a question about. You said that he would be able to do the things that he alleged that he was denied access to if he were properly treated. What does that mean?
Well, his handwritten pro se complaint is not the picture of lucidity, to be
sure. But there was a hearing. We had an evidence.
There was a Spears hearing. And it seemed to deal more with Section 1983 than it dealt with his ADA claim.
But you did it in your brief regarding the ADA, and that's my question. What do you mean? Are you saying that he's not eligible, he's not physically or mentally able to participate unless he's treated?
Yes. He alleged that he has two disabilities, hepatitis C, which affects one's liver, as well as various psychiatric disorders, including post-traumatic stress disability. He's also alleged that he was qualified for but was denied the benefit of various programs, services, and activities within the state prison system solely because of his disability. Well, specifically, he said he was denied. He was actually in a restitution center and then was told to leave that center because they couldn't handle somebody with his disability. That's number one.
But you're saying he had to be treated or he was not qualified. That's my question.
Well, the question is, was he eligible for the program, service, or activity apart from his disability? And the answer is yes, he was eligible. The problem is he needed an accommodation. And what he alleged was that he needed the accommodation of a doctor at the various locations where these satellite programs or the restitution center was administering some sort of medication. And that was the accommodation that he alleged, and that's the accommodation that he said he was deprived of. So I think it's fair to say that he has stated a claim for relief under Title II, and significantly no one has contended otherwise.
What's the difference between that and deliberate indifference to serious medical needs, which is essentially his 1983 claims that he was primarily concerned with, you say?
Well, I think the difference is that one involves accommodations and whether the state made reasonable efforts to accommodate his disability. And in this case, it amounts to it's not so much that he was deprived of adequate medical treatment. That was really his 1983 claim, which the court dismissed. It really amounts to the failure to give reasonable accommodations.
Reasonable accommodation is medical treatment that he's being denied.
Well, I think in his case,
you're saying then that this is medical treatment that he is entitled to, not under the Eighth Amendment, but under Title II?
Yes, Judge Jolly. It's an ADA claim where basically he's saying that I was qualified and
It doesn't amount to a constitutional violation. You're assuming, you're telling us that.
Right. When the court defined this issue for me, I was told to assume that there was no constitutional violation, which I have. But yet I was told to assume that there is a violation of the ADA. And I think he has stated a claim for violation of the ADA. He's alleged the particular disabilities,
how do we know that Congress intended to address the 19 the denial of medical treatment under Title II when it was covered under 1983. Do we?
Well, there's no question but that Title II reaches conduct and imposes burdens that go beyond the 14th Amendment. There's no question about it. And that's why we're here on this particular issue as to whether...
What you're saying, it seems to me, is that if he had adequate medical treatment, that he would be able to perform these tasks that he's been denied because he didn't have medical treatment. And your claim is nothing more than deliberate indifference to serious medical needs.
I don't think so, Judge Jolly. I think his ADA claim is more precise. He's basically saying, I was eligible for kitchen duty, and based on the fact that I was a Class 3 medical condition and a Class C psychiatric condition, based on that and nothing more, they wouldn't let me in the kitchen.
But you're saying that he had to have accommodation to qualify for those positions, and that the accommodation is attention to his medical needs.
Well, I think that's part of it. In other instances, I think he alleged I was qualified. I really didn't need any accommodation. It was simply because I was disabled that they wouldn't let me into that particular program.
What was the disability that precluded him from working in the kitchen?
That I don't know. I think they simply said because you're medical class 3 and you're psychiatric class C, you cannot work in the kitchen. Likewise, as he alleged, in the restitution center, somebody came to him and said, we're not capable of handling people like you with these disabilities, and you need
to
go.
Whenever he had his Spears hearing to explain all of his problems and what he was actually being denied and what they said to him, what did he say that the prison system indicated was the basis of denying him the right to work in the kitchen?
All he said at the Spears hearing was that simply because he was medical class 3 and psychiatric class C, he was denied access to the kitchen. Likewise, he was turned away from the restitution center, and likewise, he was denied access to various satellite facilities. That was really the extent of it, and that's what he alleged in his handwritten complaint and likewise alleged in his handwritten brief in this court. So I think there is an adequate basis to conclude that he stated a claim under Title II of the ADA and thus enabling us to reach the issue that the court identified for supplemental briefing.
Are we proceeding on the sovereign immunity piece? That this is the only issue here is there's irrational discrimination and that's it, based on disability?
The way I put it, Judge Owen, is that he was denied access to programs, services, and activities based upon his disability, which states a claim under Title II of the ADA.
Does it matter to us, should we be concerned about, in the Supreme Court's decision in Lane, they talked about strong measures appropriate to address one harm may be unwarranted, an unwarranted response to another. It seems like to me damages for certain things under Title II might be appropriate in a prison setting, but not for others. I mean, should we try to delve into just beyond the penal aspect, the penal setting here, and go in a much more particularized examination?
I think the answer to that is no. I think the question of congruence and proportionality simply asks for whether there's a whether there's a match between the ends to be achieved and the means used to achieve those ends. So in this particular case, I think the question is, first of all, do we have evidence here of unconstitutional disability discrimination in the state prison system as a whole?
Well, that's my point. Here he's basically saying, I want a doctor who's able to treat my condition at every penal institution in the state of Mississippi so that I can be transferred to whichever penal institution I choose and have adequate medical care for me. And as opposed to situations that are in the congressional record, in the briefs that are far different, where someone is in a wheelchair and can't move for 24 hours, is sitting in their feces and urine for days. I mean, there's, to me, a very different, on the continuum here, those are very different things. Should we be concerned with that level of particularity in determining whether the congressional allowances of damages, waiving sovereign immunity, just pushes all sovereign immunity aside in a penal setting, irrespective of the state's conduct?
Well, the problem is there was such a history here of unlawful discrimination in the area of disability that Congress has made a reasonable conclusion that it needed to take relatively powerful measures to deter disability discrimination conduct in the future. And because of that, I think Title II is a measured response. Title II is limited and it's narrowly targeted in contrast to the very expansive statutes that were held in the Bernie case, for example, and the Garrett case not to abrogate immunity. And to be sure, we are reaching out and we are dealing with conduct that may not rise to the level of constitutional violations, but I think Congress has made the determination that we need to do that in order to deter the unconstitutional conduct that historically has proven to exist in the state prison system. Now, importantly, I think, Title II is limited and it is narrowly targeted. Just because one can state a claim under the ADA does not mean one is going to prevail. Title II is limited to only qualified disabled persons who are otherwise eligible for the program, service, or activity.
We're talking about here only damages, correct?
Yes.
And in order to be entitled to damages, you concede that you had to allege intentional discrimination?
I'm not sure about intentional discrimination, Judge Jolly. I think it would be enough to show that he was denied access to a program, service, or activity for which he was otherwise qualified. I think a good example of that is in the Yeske case, 1998 case from the U.S. Supreme Court, where the ADA was held to extend to an inmate who was denied access, a disabled inmate, who was denied access to a boot camp program that would have allowed him to be released on parole in 6 months, whereas instead he had to serve 18 to 36 months. So I think you can see that being deprived of access to a service, a program, or activity simply based upon your disability can be damaging.
But again, that's on a continuum where it seems to me there's a difference, material difference between those facts and these facts. I mean, he's not alleging that denial of his access to any of these programs extended his prison stay, that he was physically harmed, there was an Eighth Amendment violation of any sort. It's simply that I want to be able to serve, I want to be able to have this job, I want to be in this prison, I want to work in the kitchen.
Well, when he talked about being sent out of the restitution center, I think that does affect his ability to,
What did he mean by that?
As I understand the restitution center system in Mississippi, it's the ability to somebody to live for somebody to live in something akin to a halfway house. Somebody who's not quite ready to go out into society, and yet somebody who should not be institutionalized in a prison like the Southern Mississippi Correctional.
That he has to have accommodation for that as well. A doctor has to go with him to the restitution house?
He did not allege that. On that particular one, he alleged that he was there and that one of the authorities came up to him and said, we're not equipped to handle somebody like you with your, presumably with your mental and physical limitations, and as such, we're sending you back to the SCMI. And
What kind of mental limitations does he admit?
He alleged that I'm sorry?
Or does he claim?
Yeah, he alleges that he has post-traumatic stress disability. I believe he's a veteran. He alleges that he has various other disorders, an explosive temper disorder, other psychological disorders that he named in his complaint. The physical disorder is simply hepatitis C.
Here's my, I guess, broad question. I mean, it's one thing to impose damages on a state when they treat disabled inmates the way that it's been described in some of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions.
Right.
When you're in a wheelchair, you can't turn, you can't get to the restroom or the shower, all of the litany of situations. It's, to me, quite another to impose damages on the state when they don't provide medical treatment for this guy at every single institution that he would like, to which he would like to be transferred, or they don't treat him in such, medically medicate him in such a way that he's able to work in the kitchen just because he chooses to, not because it's medically necessary. Or do you see the huge exposure to damages that the states have regarding the prisons? Is that a measured, prophylactic, reasonably targeted response, congressional response?
Well, interestingly, the state hasn't said that it is, that it's,
I'm not
unreasonable,
asking what the state says. I'm asking you, this isn't a waiver argument.
No, I agree with that. No, I think it is a reasonable measured response. For example, in Lane, there was alleged to be a claim of denial of access to the courts that everybody conceded did not rise to the level of a constitutional violation. It was simply a court reporter not being able to access certain courts to do her job. And notwithstanding the fact that that did not rise to the level of a constitutional violation, that it was a mere violation of Title II of the ADA, the court held in Lane that that sovereign immunity was abrogated. Why? Because it was a reasonable means to effectuate a legitimate end. And I don't think you can parse through each case or each instance.
Denial of access to courts, in effect, though. I mean, it was a substantial discrimination, constitutional discrimination, really.
Well, except that in Georgia, the courts acknowledged that there was not a constitutional violation alleged in Lane. Likewise, in the Hibbs case involving the Family Medical Leave Act, the court in Georgia likewise said that there was not a constitutional violation there.
But in a footnote 20, they said this case implicates the right of access to the courts,
right,
which is a constitutional due process right. So it at least implicates it. It didn't say there was a violation. And they said we don't have to decide, therefore, what the Constitution requires in the class of cases that implicate only prohibition on irrational discrimination. So it seems to me we are assuming we're in the category of prohibiting only irrational discrimination unless you tell us otherwise. I mean, is there a case that implicates some constitutional right like the right of access to courts here?
Well, yes. In Georgia, the court said that Title II implicates a constellation of constitutional rights. To begin with, we have the Eighth Amendment. We have due process. We have equal protection. This case really, our particular case, implicates, is rooted in equal protection. It doesn't rise to the level of an equal protection violation, but it's rooted in that, just as the conduct in Lane was rooted in a right of access to the courts, even though it didn't rise to the level of constitutional violation. So, to be sure, Title II goes beyond the 14th Amendment, but the question is it congruent and proportional? And I submit that it is, under any measure adopted by the court in Lane and under any measure adopted by the court in Hibbs.
Thank you, Mr. Levenger.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes. Ms. Hall, representing the Attorney General.
May it please the court. Felicia Hall here representing the appellees. Christopher Epps, the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Ronald King, who is a superintendent at the South Mississippi Correctional Institute, and Mike Hatton, who is a compliance officer located at the South Mississippi Correctional Institute. And it's our positions, Your Honor, that the lower court was correct in its ruling in finding that the state was entitled to sovereign immunity in this case, and that the plaintiff failed to state a valid ADA claim. And generally speaking, we recognize that the 11th Amendment precludes actions against the state in their official capacity, since individuals in their official capacity, since such suits are considered suits against the state. However, we do concede and recognize that Congress's intent in this passing Title II of the ADA was to abrogate the state's immunity. But the question that is presented before this court is whether Congress actually had the power to carry out its intent. It's our position that this is a case of first impression for this court, simply for the fact that the question was left open in the U.S. versus Georgia case, where the court ruled that Congress can abrogate a state's 11th Amendment immunity when there is an actual violation of the 14th Amendment. And here, we find that there is no 14th Amendment violation. We think the court, the lower court, got it correct when it found that there was no actual violation. And I think this court touched on it perfectly when it said that, is this merely a case of deliberate indifference under 1983? We believe that it is, that this is not a valid ADA claim. What we have here is someone complaining about access to services which he would not constitutionally be entitled to. We have a prisoner who wanted access to work in a prison kitchen. He wanted to be housed in a particular prison facility, and he wanted access to certain educational programs in prison. And this is in the context of the penal system, and their rights are different. And we believe the court is clear. The courts have ruled clearly that there are no constitutional rights under those issues. Specifically, the court ruled that a prisoner does not have a constitutional right to educational or vocational training, and that's in the Beck versus Lionel case. A prisoner does not have a constitutional right to be incarcerated in a particular prison or facility.
Why should the state be allowed to deny educational opportunities to an inmate simply because he's disabled?
Your Honor, and I don't believe that was simply the reason why there was a denial. And we don't believe that a simple denial based on a disability is the reason. What we believe Title II would serve to do in this case would be expand the rights under the Constitution. And the case law is clear that there is no constitutional right for a prisoner to have educational opportunities. While we might not like that, and it seems a little, implausible for that to be the case, but it simply is the current state of the law that a prisoner does not have a constitutional right to for educational programs. And certainly, he doesn't have a constitutional right to work in a prison kitchen. He's simply claiming, they wouldn't let me work in the kitchen. And the case law is clear that they don't have a certain right to job assignments or particular assignments behind prison walls. And
that's did your clients ever allege in the district court that he had not, in fact, stated a claim under this Title II?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did your clients ever allege in district court that he had not, in fact, stated a claim under Title II?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe we actually got to that point in the district court because when there
should we get there first?
In determining whether or not there was a Title II violation?
No, in determining the sovereign immunity issue. Should we first even determine whether a claim under Title II has been stated?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. I believe that we should get to the sovereign immunity issue first.
Did the state of Mississippi ever file an answer to any complaint in this case?
Yes, they did, Your Honor. And in the answer...
And in that answer, did you say he failed to state a claim upon which relief could be granted?
Yes, Your Honor. That was one of the affirmative defenses included in the answer, that he failed to state a claim and that he and that the defendants were also entitled to sovereign immunity. So both defenses were alleged in the initial pleading. And when the court had its Spears hearing, there was, you know, only testimony from the plaintiff, and he put forth everything that he believed was an allegation in this case. And like counsel,
the
simply...
The state of Mississippi was not represented at the Spears hearing, was it?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And like counsel has simply stated, he put in his brief that he would have had access to these programs if he had had medical treatment. And the accommodation that the Title II of the ADA is simply not just for medical treatment. There is no, as we said, no constitutional right for the things that he's claiming. We don't have a case, as Judge Owen, you pointed out, with regard to an inmate who doesn't have wheelchair access or someone who's forced to sit in his own feces for an extended period of time. And we were recently dealt with the issue where the Department of Corrections had to actually deal with an ADA claim where they had to respond to certain accommodations from a disabled inmate with regard to retrofitting their prison system to accommodate someone who was a paraplegic in the system. And certainly that's not the case here today, and that case is actually pending before this court, Paul Morgan versus the state of Mississippi. So with regard to that, simply wanting the things that he wants as far as working in a prison kitchen, access to certain educational facilities, and to be housed in a particular prison facility is not a constitutional claim.
But the U.S. Supreme Court seems to have said that you don't have to have a constitutional violation in order for Section 5 of the 14th Amendment authorize Congress to enact prophylactic measures. So where are we?
Well, Your Honor, I agree that the court did say that. However, if you look to the reasoning in the court in Tennessee versus Lane, the court says specifically, and I'll quote to you, while Congress must have wide berth in devising appropriate remedial preventive measures for unconstitutional conduct, those measures may not work a substantive change in the governing law. And again, the governing law in this case is that this particular individual would not have a constitutional right to the claims that he's alleging. And Title II in this particular case would not serve to remedy any wrong here. And it would simply serve to expand the constitutional rights. And that was simply not the intent, we believe, of Congress in this particular case. And if the court would go with me to the City of Bourne case, the holding in Bourne stands for the premise that only the court can interpret the Constitution for a true separation of powers between Congress and the judiciary. And the intent of the Bourne decision, as was used by the lower court, was to prevent a considerable congressional intrusion into the state's traditional prerogatives and general authority. And in the prison context, prison administration is generally given wide latitude to act, and the courts generally do not interject themselves into that particular situation absent extraordinary measures. And there are no extraordinary measures in this case. We have a simple claim by Mr. Hale that he wanted access to certain programs, and it wasn't because of his disability.
Okay, so I understand your position now to be different from the one that you earlier took, in which you joined the United States in its request to remand the case for determination of whether Title II had actually been violated.
Sure, Your Honor, and if I may respond, this is an inherited case that once I got when I came to the Attorney General's office, and it was my understanding that previous counsel had already asserted some sort of waiver with the Department of Justice, and considering that, it was our position that we were boxed in. However, once we got a question or inquiry from the court about our position, we went a little further to respond to say that it was never an intent from the state to waive any sovereign immunity claim, especially considering one that would extend that waiver to the whole class of cases. So that was never an intent.
The state disassociates itself from that earlier expressed viewpoint.
Absolutely, Your Honor, absolutely. And it maintains its request for sovereign immunity and believes that the underlying court got it right. In essence, Your Honor, we believe that Title II of the ADA could impose liability where there should be none in this case because there are no constitutional rights that were violated. And based on the foregoing and the current state of the law, we believe that this court should affirm the lower court's ruling in finding, one, that the state is entitled to its sovereign immunity, and two, that there was no valid ADA claim, and that this court should not remand the case for further proceedings, but that the decision has already been decided.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hall.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips from the Department of Justice, who is the intervener in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The Justice Department, or the United States, is here in a very limited capacity, which is strictly to defend the constitutionality of the provision of the ADA that abrogates immunity under the 11th Amendment. In this case, there's both a procedural and a substantive aspect to that. I'd like to start with the procedural issue and then be happy to answer any questions the court may have on the substantive issue. As we explained in our brief, we view Georgia as setting down a three-part test for analyzing these claims, or 11th Amendment challenges to Title II of the ADA. In our view, this test essentially formalizes the principle of constitutional avoidance. In other words, it requires district courts to look at any other way to resolve the case, starting with whether or not a Title II claim has been stated, before actually reaching the issue on which this court asked for supplemental briefing. As the party responsible for defending the constitutionality of the federal statutes, the United States has a very strong interest in making sure that these procedural steps are followed. And that is one of the primary reasons for our involvement in this case.
You recognize there's some tension. I mean, absolutely, in most cases, the rule is you don't reach a constitutional issue unless you have to. But the flip side of this coin is sovereign immunity is for the states. They don't have to defend cases for which they have immunity. You don't decide the merits before you decide immunity.
I understand that tension, Your Honor. Our position is that that was resolved in Georgia. And I would, to the extent that there's any doubt on the mandatory nature of the three-step process in Georgia, I would direct the court to the Zibel case, Z-I-B-B-E-L-L, which is cited in our brief. It's admittedly an unpublished opinion from the Sixth Circuit, but it details the Sixth Circuit's history with this issue, and they had dealt with it in a prior case and been reversed by the Supreme Court and had it in a prior case called Haas, H-A-A-S. They were reversed by the Supreme Court and remanded, and in light of that, they certainly view the three-step process that's set down in Georgia as mandatory, and we believe that is the correct interpretation of Georgia. And I think this case is a perfect example of that. You know, the district court that did not address the first step of Georgia did not definitively determine whether or not there was a Title II claim. And Your Honor, I think that goes to some of your concerns that you were raising with Mr. Levenger. Issues as to whether or not a doctor, for example, has to be present at regional facilities, things like that, those are issues that are better dealt with at as part of the inquiry into whether or not a Title II claim has been stated. I mean, this, as we detail, I think it's at pages 32 and 33 of our brief, Title II sets up.
Did anybody ask the district court to do that? That's another problem here. It doesn't appear as if anybody asked the district court to do that first.
Obviously, Your Honor, we were not involved at the district court level.
What does the record reflect?
I'm sorry?
What does the record reflect?
I'm not aware that anybody asked the district court to do that. Our position would be that the district court was aware of the Supreme Court's decision in Georgia and that it was required.
So that you want us to reverse on plain error?
Well, I don't know that I would categorize it. I mean, I suppose that's one way the court could categorize it. It's simply a failure to follow the steps set forth in Georgia. And I would also point to, if I remember correctly, I believe 1915, which is the statute.
And nobody objected. So it's kind of plain error review.
That would certainly be a way for this court to address it, Your Honor.
You've got to have a standard of review.
Certainly, Your Honor.
It would be plain error.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think that is certainly one way to categorize it. It would be a...
But it's another way to categorize it.
I believe, the proper way to categorize it. Our position would be that this is required by Georgia. It may also be required by 1915, which I believe requires district courts to determine whether or not a claim has been stated. So under either of those principles, I think the district court erred in not definitively resolving the question whether or not a Title II claim had been stated.
But then that does put the burden on you to show the burden on the plaintiff to show his substantial rights were affected by the failure to examine first whether there was a Title II violation. And to show that, he would have to almost show that there was, in fact, a Title II violation. Otherwise, his substantial rights wouldn't be affected.
I guess it could be a question as to whether the plaintiff or the defendant would have to show that, since the issue is whether or not the plaintiff stated a title. I mean, here that the plaintiff got the benefit essentially of the district court's skipping of the first step of the Georgia process, because what the district court did essentially is say, I'm going to assume arguendo that he stated a claim, which is, I assume, one reason why Mr. Levenger is disagreeing with us on that issue. But if I could come back to a point that Judge Owen raised, I see my time is getting short. You had asked essentially how wide a net do you cast in looking at the activity involved in this case versus the activity that's some of which is cited in our brief, you know, other activity in the prison context that may make a somewhat stronger case. We think the proper framework for that is the Supreme Court's approach in Lane. The two plaintiffs in Lane, one was a criminal defendant who was unable to reach the courtroom. The other was a court reporter who was unable to access certain courthouses. Congress is obviously a national legislature and has to legislate nationally.
I mean, but your argument is along the lines of what Judge Owen said, is the 11th Amendment doesn't mean a thing in this case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The 11th Amendment doesn't mean a thing in this case from your point of view, because you're saying the 11th Amendment is immunity from suit. And you're saying before you can claim 11th Amendment immunity, you've got to go down and try the case. And that's not immunity from suit.
Admittedly, Your Honor, that is the way it's been set up in Georgia. And we believe that is what the Supreme Court has said lower courts are to do, and we believe that must be followed.
Well, you admit that means nothing in the 11th Amendment means nothing in the light of those that hold it?
No, I would not.
What does it mean, then?
It means it's been abrogated in this,
not really.
Again, Your Honor, this is what the Supreme Court has set forth in Georgia.
Can you briefly, you were saying about in Lane that there would involve the criminal defendant and the court reporter?
Yes.
And
yes, Your Honor. The approach in Lane was not to limit it to just the claims that were presented by those plaintiffs. The court looked at the class of cases involving access to the courts, which I think is somewhat broader than what the specific plaintiffs were raising in that issue. We would respectfully submit that the proper class here is the class of cases involving Title II claims in the ADA context, that it's not limited to just the individual claims that the plaintiff raises in this case, and some of the concerns I think that Your Honor was raising are better dealt with in the context of determining whether or not a Title II claim has been stated, which again dovetails with our point about sending this back and having the district court do a full analysis on the Title II issue in the first instance. Again, we would ask the court to remand the matter to the district court.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Levenger, you have some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make four brief points. First of all, to correct something Ms. Hall stated, the parties to the ADA claim, Epps, King, and Hatton, did not move to dismiss in the lower court. They were added as ADA defendants. They did not file a motion to dismiss the ADA claim, nor have they ever contended on appeal that Mr. Hale failed to state a claim under the ADA. So I do not think this case is appropriate for remand to determine whether an ADA claim has been stated. An ADA claim has been stated, and nobody has contended otherwise. And Judge Jolly, this is my second point. I agree with you. I think immunity is a threshold issue that should be taken up first. It's not a mere defense to liability. It provides immunity from suit. And as such, I think this issue is ripe for consideration by this court. Obviously, this court thought so in identifying the immunity abrogation issue for supplemental briefing. So I think the issue is squarely before the court. It needs to be determined. It's a question that was left open in U.S. versus Georgia, and it, frankly, is time to resolve.
We do have a scant record here on exactly what he's claiming. You would concede that?
Yes. It is scant. But I think there's enough to state a claim under the ADA. I suspect that if it goes back on remand, we'll be right back up here on the immunity issue.
Can we say with confidence that there's no Eighth Amendment claim here? That we're in the situation that Justice Scalia was talking about, that they might be in on remand in Georgia?
I think we can say with confidence that there is not an Eighth Amendment claim here.
Why?
He hasn't alleged anything in his complaint that, in my view, compared to the other cases that we've cited in our brief, particularly in the long footnote
citing
cases.
I may have narrowed my question too much. A 14th Amendment claim.
14th Amendment? Well, that's a closer call. To be sure. I think he's come close to alleging equal protection violations, but again, I think the lower court held that he didn't have a constitutional right to work in the kitchen or to go to school or to be in the restitution center, et cetera. And this kind of ties into my third point, and that is The fact that he doesn't have a constitutional right to those things, as counsel noted, ultimately just begs the question here, because as the Supreme Court has made clear in Lane, Hibbs, and otherwise, Congress has wide latitude under Section 5 to remedy and deter violations of the 14th Amendment by prohibiting, and here's the key language, a somewhat broader swath of conduct, including conduct that is facially constitutional.
Well, what do we do about, they also said you may not work a substantive change in the governing law. They also said that.
They did say that, but I don't think Title II, just as the court concluded in Lane, works a substantive change to the 14th Amendment. Title II, compared to RFRA in the Bernie case, or some of the other statutes that have been held not to abrogate immunity, is quite narrowly tailored. It very much aligns with the constitutional jurisprudence dealing with the rights of prisoners. I'm referring
well,
to the Turner case.
It makes the state liable for a whole host of things, that money damages that would not have been before.
Well, but that's Congress's decision. That's why we defer to Congress, who determined based on this long, sordid history of discrimination against disabled inmates that we need to address a somewhat broader swath of conduct. That may reach non-constitutional violations is simply the consequence of applying Lane, Hibbs, and cases of that nature. I think it is valid prophylactic legislation in view of, A, the history that we have, and B, as the court stated in Lane, the narrowly tailored nature of Title II.
Okay, and the injury to be prevented in this case is what?
Well, an ADA violation. But
Of what magnitude?
I'm sorry?
Of what magnitude?
Well, denial of access to programs, services, and activities, and this really now ties into my last point. Mr. Hale's not saying that programs, services, and activities need to be created for him. Title II does not require preferences. What he's saying is that if they exist, and they do exist in the state of Mississippi, he can't be denied the benefits of them simply because he's disabled. And that rises to the level of an ADA violation. It may not be precisely...
Is having a physician for him during his classes or in every prison institution he might want to attend or in the kitchen, is that a reasonable accommodation?
If he's qualified, if he's eligible, then Title II would say yes. And if the state needs to give him a reasonable modification, the state has the opportunity to come back and say this would fundamentally alter the nature of the service or program, or this would impose undue burdens, administrative burdens or expenses. That's all embedded within Title II in the regulations, and that's why I say that it's a narrowly tailored and appropriate legislative means to accomplish the ends that Congress was concerned about. I hope I've answered the court's question.
Mr. Levenger, thank you very much. You were court-appointed in this case, and you've done an admirable job for your client, and the court expresses its appreciation.
Thank you, Your Honor.